Underworld, Disc 6.
Chapter 2. Marion Shay drove up to Prescott on business, allowing herself one cigarette for the two-hour trip, which she managed not to smoke until she was 10 miles from town, where the mobile homes began to gather and the fast food blazed, and she felt good about this, controlled and disciplined and clean deep through. There was something going on the courthouse square. She parked a block away and walked back down to the square, and it was one of those days in the high pines when the sun and sweet breeze get into your underwear. There were cars arrayed on a closed-off street, four rows of vintage machines extending two city blocks along the edge of the plaza, and loudspeakers on the lawn did dance party rock and roll. She had 15 minutes to spare and walked among the cars, many with hoods raised for the pleasure of connoisseurs. It was early, not yet 11, and only a dozen people wandered about. She saw a red-haired man who looked faintly familiar, and watched him bend under a hood and then stand back to appraise a customized Buick with a black lacquered chassis. He stood donnishly posed with jutted elbow and cupped hand, and she realized after a moment that he worked with Nick at Waste Containment, and that his name, which took another moment, was Brian Glassick, which rhymes with classic, which describes these cars. He saw her and showed a beam of recognition. Then he did a little dance from half a block away, the slowest of clinging foxtrots from out of the 50s. About 2 hours later, they met for lunch in the dining room of an old hotel just up the street. The room was close and warm, and she held the glass of ice water up against her face. He said, "You were here?" "For a job interview. There's a small design firm here that renovates old structures. They want to open a Phoenix office. I would be it."
"How did it go?"
"All right, I think."
"You've done this kind of work?"
"Not exactly. Before the kids, I helped manage a small real estate operation. Since the kids, I've done part-time things now and then."
"Your own office? This is a fantasy of mine. To come wandering in just before lunch, like a private detective, hung over, a face full of stubble, riffle through the mail, throw it down."
"Do you get stubble?" she said.
"Yes, eventually. Why do you ask?"
"I don't know. I thought maybe the smoother and fairer the complexion."
"We do shave," he said.
"I don't think my office will resemble a private detective's."
"You want light and air?"
"Great thick proposals and strong minders."
"You want scale models with trees?"
"Maybe."
"And little bland people on the sidewalk?"
"Multiracially bland."
"Bravo. Want a drink?"
"Why not?"
she said.
Brian ordered drinks from an old fellow who probably doubled as hall porter. She said, "And you are here?"
"For the cars. I read about the show last night and felt a sort of schoolboy itch."
"Couldn't even wait for the weekend?"
"Crowded. I deserve a day off, anyway."
"You had to wait around for lunch, I'm sorry. I thought you had a business appointment."
"I'm not finished with the cars. They're worth a second look. And what could be nicer than sitting here waiting for someone to bring our drinks and fix the air conditioner and do something about the stuffing in the banquettes?"
"Is that what smells?" she said.
She smoked, of course. Once she ordered the drink, she knew the facade would crumble. It took very little to bring it down. She would smoke all she had and then find more. He made her laugh a few times, and was funny even when he wasn't trying to be. She thought he probably had a rabbit for a pet when he was small, but she wasn't sure why this made sense. "You're tall, aren't you?" He asked this suspiciously, as if she'd been concealing it.
"No taller than you."
"My wife is small. Have you met her?"
"I'm not sure."
"She wants me to take her to New York next month. I have to consult with engineers at the Fresh Kills landfill, which is sort of the King Kong of American garbage mounds."
Does Nick like this kind of work?
You're asking me? He said.
Yes, I'm asking you.
I think he likes it more than I do. I think he sees it in purer terms, concepts and principles. Because this is Nick, the technology, the logic, the aesthetics. Whereas I, in my little gringo mindset...
You're moving into new quarters. That may help your self-image.
Yes, a great bronze tower. Just like an investment firm or media giant. Of course, the structure resembles a geometric turd, but that's only fitting, no?
The man brought their drinks, and they looked at the menus in the nearly empty room. They talked and looked, not really looking, looking and forgetting. Marion felt the nice bite of the gin, and wondered what it was about Brian that made him so easy to talk to. She thought he went around scared most of the time, but didn't try to hide it from women. Some women, anyway. Maybe the rare woman he runs into 100 miles from home, and he falls all over himself with honesty and self-scathing insight, the things he does not normally show the boys. To reciprocate, perhaps, she didn't know why else she'd tell the dog story, if not to strut her own confessional skills. They had another drink and ordered lunch. The dog barked and whined incessantly. Dookie. But the kids were small, and they loved their dog, and he barked, he cried, he went bye-bye in the house. He yapped at the other kids, and the neighbors complained, and I secretly tried to give him away, but no one would take him. And so I finally, on an impulse... This is awful. Why am I telling you this?
Because the story haunts you, because you see mercy in my eyes.
Yes, a frantic impulse. I convinced myself the dog was miserable and sick and suffering, some irreversible thing, and I drove out on 85, I think it is, down past some dam into stark, stony desert, much farther than I absolutely had to go, and I just kept going and going and finally stopped the car and opened the door and set Dookie out on the ground and then drove home and told Lainey, "Sweetheart, the dog ran away, and I'm so sorry." But I didn't let it go at that. I went reeling out of control. I started driving them through the streets, both kids, day after day, calling out the windows for Dookie, Dookie. And it haunts me, yes, like something I only dreamed. And what a relief it is to realize it didn't actually happen.
And then you realize it did happen. Brian was enjoying this immensely, and so she began to enjoy it too, which was probably the point, she thought.
Driving through the dead summer streets in the long afternoons, I can hear their voices. Dookie! Dookie! They were 5 and 3, I think, calling out the windows for their dog. She was nearly laughing, crying, looking at Brian's mug alight with pleasure and feeling the misery and shame of her act, and smoking in the middle of a meal in an empty dining room where the air conditioner is not responding. He said,
"Dookie, Dookie!"
Dukino, actually. Little Duke. Nick came up with the name. Do you know he's half Italian?
Our Nick? When did this happen?
You don't see it in his face?
I hear it in that voice he does.
What voice?
The gangster making threats.
What gangster? It's a voice he does. Expert. Stereotyped. Pretty funny. Speaking of backgrounds, she said, and if this is too personal, you don't have to answer, but did you ever have a rabbit for a pet? They were having a fine time. When he talked, she found herself sorting through the responses, getting them ready, one after another. And sometimes she broke in irresistibly and watched his face go bright. She told him she played field hockey in school and missed it. She missed drinking from a garden hose. She missed her mother and father more than ever, and they'd been dead 9 years and 6 years and were stronger forces now, so deeply present in her life that she understood completely how people see ghosts and have conversations with the dead. She had a garden hose but didn't drink from it, and didn't allow her kids to drink from it, And this was the difference, less in lost things than in knowledge become suspicious and alert. She told him she missed smoking, even though she hadn't been able to stop. When they were finished, they walked up a stairway to the lobby, and in her mind she kept ascending to a shadowed room at the end of a long, empty hall, and saw herself folding down the bedspread and standing above the cool sheets, waiting for a knock at the door. Then they heard plaintive falsettos from the loudspeakers on the courthouse lawn, and they walked down to the cars in the easy heat. Brian went into a state of body rapture over a lime sherbet Chevrolet, a 57 Bel Air convertible with white upholstery. He draped himself over the hood and pretended to lick the hot metal. Marion thought this is what men get instead of fatty deposits around the thighs. But she had to admire the car, which was carefree and racy and even great in a way. The chromium sweep of it, and the funny and touching music that bared its innocence. Brian detached himself from the hood. "Did you own one?" "Too young," he said. "My oldest brother had one for a while. Brendan's Bel Air. We still talk about it in awed tones. It was the high point of his life. It meant everything to him. Girls, love, personality, power. It meant the moment." All those cars had the so-called forward look, sleek as jet fighters. But it turned out that forward didn't mean the future. It meant do it now, have your fun, because the 60s are coming. Bow wow, bang bang. The engine had a throaty roar. We couldn't know it at the time, but it's been downhill for Brendan ever since. They walked under the elms at the edge of the square. His car was parked by the old city jail, which was the Chamber of Commerce now. They spoke oddly polite goodbyes. She thought maybe they felt guilty about something and needed to prepare their faces for the journey home, get the noise out of the system. She walked up the street to her car and felt the liquid pulse of the sun in every step. Chapter 3. Brian drove due north, looking for a sign that would lead him to the bridge. A sludge tanker moved downriver, funky and low-slung. He felt the old foreboding. It wasn't widely known, it was narrowly known, that he experienced terrible things every time he crossed a bridge. The longer and higher the span, the greater his sense of breathless abyss. And this was a major bridge over a broad and historic body of water. The truth of bridges is that they made him feel he was doing some Mobius gyration, becoming one-sided, losing all purchase on name and place and food taste and weekends with the in-laws, hanging sort of unborn in generic space. Then he saw it in the distance, steel-beamed and cabled, sweeping to the palisaded bank. He followed the signs, made the loops, and started out across the bridge, choosing the upper level because the long gray Lincoln in front of him went that way. Lincoln and Washington keep me safe. The radio was ablast with call-in voices. They're griping, they're spraying spit. It's the sidewalk salvo and rap. And he imagined a long queue of underground souls waiting to enter the broadcast band and speak the incognito news. He listened in solemn gratitude. It was a clamor so strong it amounted to a life force, carrying this Ohio boy through his white anxiety and across to the Jersey side. He was looking for 46 West. He'd written out directions that the man had recited over the phone. The man had recited the routes and streets in a manner so automatic that Brian realized many pilgrims had made the trip across the river. He had the directions written on hotel stationery, and he kept the page on the seat next to him, snatching a look every 10 seconds. After a mile on 46 West, he spotted the Exxon station and made the maneuver onto 63 South, racing along the 3-mile stretch to the Point Diner. Then he made a left turn out of the howl of highly motivated traffic and into residential streets, beginning to relax at last, approaching the circle on Kennedy Drive, another dead president. Down a side street to an old frame house. Marvin Lundy opened the door, a hunched fellow with a stylized shuffle, in his late 60s, holding a burnt-out cigar. Brian thought he resembled some retired stand-up comic who will not live a minute longer than his last monopolized conversation. He followed the man through two rooms steeped in Aquarian dimness. Then they went to the basement, a large finished room that held Marvin Lundy's collection of baseball memorabilia.
"My late wife. She would serve us tea with popovers as she made fresh, all other things being equal."
The room was filled with objects on tasteful display. Flannel jerseys draped along the walls, caps with souvenir buttons pinned to the visors. There were newspaper pages framed and hung. Brian did a reverent tour, examining autographed bats ranked on custom wall fittings. Game bats, beautifully grained, some with pine tar on the choke. There were stadium seats, labeled like rare botanical specimens. Ebbets Field, Scheib Park, Griffith Stadium. He nearly touched an old catcher's mitt set on a pedestal. The object gashed yellow, spike-gashed and sun-smoked and patriarchal, but he managed to hold back. He looked at autographed baseballs in plexiglass globes. He leaned over display cases that held cigarette cards, ticket stubs, the signed contracts of famous players, 19th-century baseball board games, bubblegum wrappers that carry the pinkish likenesses of men from Brian's youth, their names a kind of poetry floating down the decades.
"You would put strawberry preserves on the popovers, which, forget it, all life from the Renaissance onward, it pales by compare."
None of this amounted to an astonishment. It was interesting, even moving in a way, but not great or memorable. The wondrous touch, the outlandish and surpassing fancy, was the large construction along the far wall, a replica of the old Polo Ground scoreboard and clubhouse facade. It covered an area about 22 feet long and 12 feet high, floor to ceiling, and included the Chesterfield sign and slogan, the Longines clock, a semblance of the clubhouse windows and parapet, and finally a hand-slotted line score, the inning-by-inning tally of the famous playoff game of 1951.
"You would have to eat them hot. She made a strict rule of no dawdling, Eleanor, because lukewarm, you lose the whole experience."
Brian stood near the scoreboard looking at Marvin for permission to touch.
"I had a draftsman, a carpenter, an electrician, and a sign painter. Not a house painter. Very temperamental. I showed them photographs, and they did measurements and sketches so they could respect the proportions and get the colors. The hit sign and the E light up, for error. Where do you live?"
"Phoenix."
"I was never there."
In the stronger light down here, I could see that Marvin Lundy's hair was a swatch of loomed synthetic, ash brown, combed sleekly forward, and it made Brian think of Las Vegas and pinky rings and prostate cancer. He said to Marvin, "I grew up in the Midwest. Cleveland Indians, that was my team. And I was flying in on business last night and saw an article in the airline magazine, the piece about you and your collectibles, and I felt a strong compulsion to get in touch with you and see these things." He fingered the silky lapel of Babe Ruth's smoking jacket.
"My daughter talked me into doing the interview," Marvin said. "She thinks I'm turning into
a recluse?"
"An old recluse with half a stomach. So now my picture's in 20,000 seat pouches. This is her idea of get out and meet people. They put me in with the vomit bags."
Brian said, "I went to a car show, and it did something to me."
"What did it do?"
"Cars from the 1950s. I don't know."
"You feel sorry for yourself. You think you're missing something, and you don't know what it is. You're lonely inside your life. You have a job and a family and a fully executed will already at your age, because the whole point is to die prepared, die legal with all the papers signed, die liquid so they can convert to cash.
You used to have the same dimensions as the observable universe. Now you're a lost speck. You look at old cars and recall a purpose, a destination. It's ridiculous, isn't it? But probably harmless, too.
Nothing is harmless, Marvin said. You're worried and scared. You see the Cold War winding down. This makes it hard for you to breathe.
Brian pushed through a turnstile from an old ballpark. It creaked, sort of lovingly. He said,
Cold War? I don't see the Cold War winding down. And if I did, good. I'd be happy about it.
Let me explain something that maybe you never noticed. Marvin was sitting in an armchair alongside an old equipment trunk, bearing the stenciled inscription, Boston Red Stockings. He gestured toward the chair on the other side of the trunk, and Brian went over and sat down.
You need the leaders of both sides to keep the Cold War going. It's the one constant thing. It's honest. It's dependable. Because when the tension and rivalry come to an end, that's when your worst nightmares begin. All the power and intimidation of the state will seep out of your personal bloodstream. You will no longer be the main... What do I want to say? I'm not sure. Point of reference. Because other forces will come rushing in, demanding and challenging. The Cold War is your friend. You need it to stay on top.
On top of what?
You don't know on top of what? You don't know the whole thing is geared to your dominance in the world? You see what they have in England? 40,000 women circling an airbase to protest the bombs and missiles. Some of them are men in dresses. They are Buddhists beating drums.
Brian didn't know how to respond to these remarks. He wanted to talk about old ballplayers, stadium dimensions, about nicknames and minor league towns. That's why he was here, to surrender himself to longing, to listen to his host recite the anecdotal texts, all the passed-down stories of bonehead plays and swirling brawls, the pitching duels that carried into twilight, stories that Marvin had been collecting for half a century, the deep eros of memory that separates baseball from other sports. Marvin sat staring at the scoreboard, his cigar slightly shredded at the burnt end.
I thought we were going to talk baseball. We're talking baseball. This is baseball. You see the clock, Marvin said, stopped at 3:58. Why? Is it because that's when Thompson hit the homer off of Branker?
He called him Branker.
Or because that's the day we found out the Russians exploded an atom bomb. You know something about that game?
What? Brian said.
There were 20,000 empty seats. You know why?
Why?
You'll laugh in my face.
No, I won't.
It's all right. You're my guest. I want you to feel at home.
Why so many empty seats for the most important game of the year?
Many years, Marvin said.
Many years?
Because certain events have a quality of unconscious fear. I believe in my heart that people sensed some catastrophe in the air. Not who would win or lose the game. Some awful force that would obliterate... What's the word?
Obliterate.
Obliterate. That would obliterate the whole thing of the game. You have to understand that all through the 1950s, people stayed indoors. We only went outside to drive our cars. Public parks were not filled with people the way they later became. A museum was empty rooms with knights in armor where you had one sleepy guard for every 7 centuries.
In other words?
In other words, there was a hidden mentality of, let's stay home, because a threat was hanging in the air.
And you're saying people had an intuition about this particular day?
It's like they knew. They sensed there was a connection between this game and some staggering event that might take place on the other side of the world. This particular game. Not the day before or the day after. Because this was an all-or-nothing game between the two hated rivals of the city. People had a premonition that this game was related to something much bigger. They had the mental process of Do I want to go out and be in a big crowd, which, if something awful happens, is the worst place to be? Or should I stay home with my family and my brand new TV, which common sense says yes, in a cabinet with maple veneer?
To his surprise, Brian did not reject this theory. He didn't necessarily believe it, but he didn't dismiss it either. He believed it provisionally, here in this room, located below street level in a frame house on a weekday afternoon in Cliffside Park, New Jersey. It was lyrically true as it emerged from Marvin Lundy's mouth and reached Brian's middle ear, unprovably true, remotely and inadmissibly true, but not completely unhistorical, not without some nuance of authentic inner narrative. Marvin said, "Which the whole thing is interesting because, when they make an atomic bomb, listen to this, they make the radioactive core the exact same size as a baseball."
"I always thought it was a grapefruit."
"A regulation Major League Baseball no less than 9 inches in circumference, going by the rule book."
He crossed his legs. He stuck a finger in his ear and jigged an itch. Marvin had enormous ears. For the first time, Brian became aware of music playing somewhere in the house. Maybe he'd been hearing it all along at the assimilated edge, music blended with the room tone, the airplanes drifting into Newark, the faint wail of bullet traffic on the speedways out there. A moderated sorrow, piano work that had the texture of something old and gentled over, a pressed rose faded in a book.
"People sense things that are invisible. But when something's staring you right in the face, that's when you miss it completely."
"What do you mean?" Brian said.
"This Gorbachev, that walks around with that thing on his head. It's a birthmark, what he's got?"
"Yes, I think so."
"It's big. You agree with this?"
"Yes, it's quite big."
"Noticeable. You can't help but notice, am I right?"
"Yes, you are."
"And you agree that millions of people see this thing every day in the newspaper?"
"Yes, they do."
"They open the paper, and there's the man's head with that amazing mark high on the dome. Agreed?"
"Yes, of course."
"What does it mean?" Marvin said.
"Why does it have to mean something?"
"You take it at face value?"
"It's his face," Brian said. "It's his head, a blemish, a birthmark."
"That's not what I see."
"What do you see?"
"You asked, so I'll tell you."
Marvin saw the first sign of the total collapse of the Soviet system. Stamped on the man's head, the map of Latvia. He said this straight-faced, how Gorbachev was basically conveying the news that the USSR faced turmoil from the republics.
"You think his birthmark? Wait a minute."
"Excuse me, but if you rotate the map of Latvia 90 degrees so the eastern border goes on top, this is exactly the shape that's on Gorbachev's head. In other words, when he's lying in bed at night, and his wife comes over to give him a glass of water and an aspirin, this is Latvia she's looking at."
Brian tried to conjure the shape of the wine-stained mark on Gorbachev's head. He wanted to match it with a memory of geography tests on mellow afternoons, his limbs faintly aching with biological drives and the sweetness of school's end. The old melodic line came lullabying back, Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania. But the map shapes escaped him now, the precise silhouettes of those nestled anatomies. Marvin was looking at the scoreboard again.
"People collect, always collecting. There's people, they go after anything out of wartime Germany. Naziana. This is major collectors looking for big history. Does that mean the objects in this room are total trivia? What's the word I'm looking for that sounds like you're getting injected with a vaccine in the fleshy part of your arm?"
"Innocuous?"
"Innocuous. What am I, innocuous? This is history. Back page. From back to front. Happy, tragic, desperate."
Marvin shifted his gaze.
"In this trunk right here, I have the one thing that my whole life, for the past 22 years, I was trying to collect."
Brian had an inkling.
"I tracked, I searched, and finally I found it.
and bought it 18 months ago. And I don't even put it on display. I keep it in the trunk, out of sight.
Now it was Brian who looked at the scoreboard. Marvin said morosely,
"It's the Bobby Thompson home run ball, which I traced it back, starting with rumors in the business. It wasn't even a business back then, just a few interested parties with someone's telephone number or first name. The skimpiest kind of lead that I pursued with a fury."
He paused to light his cigar. It was old and stale and looked like a soybean sausage from the school cafeteria. But Brian understood that a cigar was tribally required, even if the smoke stung his eyes. For the next 3 hours, Marvin talked about his search for the baseball. He forgot some names and mangled others. He lost whole cities, placing them in the wrong time zones. He described how he followed false leads into remote places. He climbed the stairs to raftered upper rooms and looked in old trunks among the grandmother's linen and the photographs of the dead.
I said to myself 1,000 times, "Why do I want this thing? What does it mean? Who has it?"
Through the narration, the whole wandering epic, skimmed here, protracted there, Brian was confident that the man was slipshod only in the telling. The search itself had clearly been hard, fierce, thorough, and consuming. At one point, Marvin hired a man who worked in a photo lab and had access to special equipment. They studied news photographs of the left field stands at the polo grounds taken just after the ball went in. They looked at enlargements and enhancements. They went to photo agencies and burrowed in the archives. Marvin had people sneak him into newspaper morgues, into the wire services and the major magazines.
"I looked at 1,000,000 photographs because this is the dot theory of reality, that all knowledge is available if you analyze the dots."
There was a slight crackle in his voice that sounded like random radio noise produced by some disturbance of the signal. He acquired original film. He brought in darkroom equipment. He ate his meals with a magnifier around his neck. The house was filled with contact sheets, glossy prints. There were blow-ups pinned to clotheslines rigged through several rooms. His wife and child fled to England to visit relatives because Marvin somehow married English. He hired a private detective with an intermittent nosebleed. They placed ads in the personal columns of sporting magazines, trying to locate people who'd sat in Section 35, where the ball went in. There was the photographic detail work, the fineness of image, the what-do-you-call-it into littler units. Resolution, Brian said. And then there was the long journey, the suitcase crawl through empty train stations, the bitter winter flights with ice on the wings. There was the weary traipse, a word he doesn't hear anymore. The march into people's houses and lives, the actual physical thing, unphotographed, of liver-spotted hands and dimpled chins and the whole strewn sense of what they remember and forget. One, the widow on Long Island turning a spoon in her cup. Two, the gospel singer named Prestigious Booker, who kept a baseball in an urn that held her lover's ashes. Three, the ship on the dock in San Francisco. Don't even bring it up. Four, the man in his car in Deaf Smith County, Texas, the original middle of nowhere. Five, the whole generation of Jesus faces. Young men everywhere, bearded and sandaled, bearded and barefoot, little peaky spectacles with wire frames. Six, Marvin's sense of being lost in America, wandering through cities with no downtowns. Seven, the woman on Long Island, what's her name, whose husband was at the game. She served instant coffee in cups from a doll museum. Eight, the Coptic family in Detroit. Never mind, it's too complicated. Riots and fires in the distance, tanks in the street. Nine, the detailed confusion of Marvin's narrative, people's memories mixed with his own, shaped to bending time. Ten, a tornado touching down, skipping along the treetops in an evil weave, the whole sky filthy with flung debris. 11, whose husband was in the footage Marvin analyzed, scrambling for the baseball,
and all she had in the house was instant. 12. Riding up the side of a building in an elevator that's transparent. 13. The ship on the dock. Please, not now. 14. What a mystery all around him. Every street deep in some radiant amaze. Brian listened to all this, and he heard the music end and begin again, the same piano piece. And this was not the second time he was hearing it, but maybe the eighth or ninth. And he listened to Marvin's dot theory of reality and felt an underlying force in this theme of the relentless photographic search, some prototype he could not bring into tight definition. 1,000 times I said, how long do I look? Why do I want it? Where is it? He advertised for amateur film footage of the game and acquired a few minutes of crude action that showed a massive pulsing blur above the left field wall shot by a man in the bleachers. He brought in an optical printer. He re-photographed the footage. He enlarged, repositioned, analyzed. He step-framed the action to slow it down, to combine several seconds of film into one image. He examined the sprocket areas of the film, searching for a speck of data, a minimum of missing imagery. It was work of Talmudic refinement, zooming in and fading out, trying to bring a man's face into definition, read a woman's ankle bracelet engraved with a name. Brian was shamed by other men's obsessions. They exposed his own middling drift. The voice he heard, soft, faint, and far away, that told him not to bother. Marvin's wife and child came home and went away again. The house had become a booby hatch of looming images. The isolated grimace, the hair that juts from the mole on the old man's chin. Every image teeming with crystallized dots. A photograph is a universe of dots. The grain, the halide, the little silver things clumped in the emulsion. Once you get inside a dot, you gain access to hidden information. You slide inside the smallest event. This is what technology does. It peels back the shadows and redeems the dazed and rambling past. It makes reality come true. Marvin Lundy opened the trunk. The baseball was wrapped in tissue paper inside an old red and white Spalding box. There were deep stacks of photographs and correspondence and other material related to the search. Birth certificates, passports, affidavits, handwritten wills, detailed lists of people's possessions. There were blood-stained garments in Ziploc bags. He took some still frames out of a manila envelope and showed them to Brian. This was a sequence that involved the scramble for the ball. People in bevies, Marvin said, scratching and grabbing. And a man in the last photo standing starkly alone, white-shirted, looking down at the exit ramp, looking hard, glaring at someone, probably at the person who'd come away with the ball. But Marvin could not find a way, for all his mastery of the dots, to rotate the heads of the people on the ramp so he could see the face of the individual in question. But you identified the man in the white shirt. From running the picture in the back of magazines where they did waterbeds and dirty personals. And you went to see the wife. This is many years after the game. What happened? He died. The widow sits in a cold house, turning a spoon in her tiny cup. I try to find out what he might have said to her about the game. The ball. Anything. What game? She says. I try to explain the extenuations of the thing. But it's more than 20 years later. What game? What ball? A woman came down the stairs carrying coffee and cheesecake on a tray. She seemed to issue from Marvin's story. A recollected figure taking material form. Marvin shut the trunk so she could place the tray on top. She was his daughter, Clarice, determined to tend to Dad whatever his objections. I didn't hear you come in. She comes in like she's Chinese, with muffled feet.
You were talking. I could be an armed robbery in progress. You wouldn't hear a thing. She was in her late 20s, blondish and gym fit. She told Brian she lived 10 minutes away by car and worked as a court stenographer. He thought he could easily fall in love with the sitcom tilt in her voice and the swerve of her thigh lines under the linen skirt.
We're almost finished here, Clarice.
In 100 grueling hours, your guest may have other things he needs to do.
What could he have?
It'll be dark soon.
Dark, light, these are words.
The baseball box was on its side among scattered photographs on the floor, and the ball had dribbled out, still crinkled in tissue. Clarice pulled up a chair, and she and Marvin finished the story, more or less, through mouthfuls of cheesecake.
For how many years, Clarice, I'm looking for a man named Jackson or Judson?
Get to the point, she said.
Because there were roundabout hints that pointed to him as someone I should be interested in. And the ball has a history by this time that I've been inching along, where different things match and join. But I can't locate the man, or even, what?
Ascertain, Brian said.
His correct name. By this time, forget the footage. I'm using rumors and dreams. There's an ESP of baseball, an underground, what? A consciousness, and I'm hearing it in my sleep.
Faster, Daddy, faster.
Meanwhile, there's this woman. I'm trying to find Judson, Jackson, Johnson, and there's this woman who got my name from the memorabilia market, and she's been calling me long-distance collect day and night. She says she used to own the thing I'm looking for. Mysteriously missing for years, she says, from the little locked box where she used to keep it.
Genevieve Roche.
Whose name I can never...
Genevieve Roche, his daughter said. And the two of them try to establish the basic, you know... Indicators? Brian said. That would make her baseball at least a remote possibility.
The marks and scratches, Marvin said. The trademark, if it's correct. The signature of the league president who was in office at the time. Her memory is iffy. I make some leeway, then she talks about something else. This is a woman. She has an extra chromosome for changing the subject. 1,000 times I'm tempted to hang up the phone.
Then it happens, Clarice said.
A man in his car.
A man's driving along in his car. Someone shoots him dead. Turns out the victim is the long-lost former husband of Genevieve Roche. Turns out further his name is Juddy Roche, Judson Roche. So the two rivers meet. Took a homicide to reveal the connection. Marvin lowered his head to the trunk top to sip his coffee, and Brian stared into the weave of his woeful toupee.
When I had my stomach, I used to eat this cheesecake unconscious.
Clarice explained how he went to Deaf Smith County, Texas, where he hired a local lawyer on behalf of Genevieve Roche and finally located the baseball, sealed in a baggie, and vouchered and numbered and stored in the property clerk's office. Impounded by the police along with the body, the car, all the things in the car, of which this was one, crammed in a cardboard box filled with junky odds and ends. Marvin puffed on his stogie.
I go all the way to the Bronx to buy this cheesecake. A kosher bakery that you couldn't find it if I gave you a road map, a guidebook, and whatever he's called that speaks 5 languages.
An interpreter.
An interpreter, Marvin said.
The cheesecake was smooth and lush, with the personality of a warm and well-to-do uncle who knows 100 dirty jokes and will die of sexual exertions in the arms of his mistress. And so, finally, Brian said, you bought the baseball.
And I traced it all the way back to October 4th, the day after the game, 1951.
And how did you finance this operation for so many years? The travel, the technical end, all of it?
I had a local chain of stores. Dry cleaning, which I sold after my wife passed away because I didn't need it anymore. The aggravation.
Marvin, the clothes king, his daughter said, with a little affection, a little regret, some irony, a certain pride, a touch of rueful humor, and so on. She talked to her father about a doctor's appointment he had in the morning, and he listened the way you listen to the TV news, staring indifferently into India. She took the tray and headed up the stairs. Brian imagined following her in his car and pulling alongside and catching her eye, and then accelerating loudly and leading her to a wayside inn where they get a room and undress each other with their teeth and tongues and never say a word. He listened to the music drifting through the house, the keyboard lament, and he finally identified the lurking presence in the story of Marvin's search, the strange second-handedness of all that exacting work, the retouching, the enhancements. It was an eerie replay of the investigations into the political murders of the 1960s. The attempt to reassemble a crucial moment in time out of patches and adumbrations. Marvin in his dark room borrowing a powerful theme and using it to locate a small, white, innocent object bouncing around a ballpark. Brian said, "So we know the lineage of the thing in the latest stages. Rosh to Lundy. But how did it all begin?"
"You asked, so I'll tell you. With a man named Charles, let me think, Wainwright, an advertising executive. I have the complete sequence back to him, the line of ownership.
But not back to the game itself.
I don't have the last link that I can connect backwards from the Wainwright ball to the ball making contact with Bobby Thompson's bat."
He looked sourly at the scoreboard clock.
"I have a certain number of missing hours I still have to find. And when you're dealing with something so many years back, you have to face the mortality rate. Wainwright passed away, and his son, Charles Jr., is 42 years old now, and stuck with the name Chucky. And I've been trying to talk to him for a long time. He was last seen working as an engineer on a freighter that plied... You like that word?
Plied.
The Baltic Sea," Marvin said. "Speaking of which..."
"Yes?"
"You should train an eye on the mark on this Gorbachev's head to see if it changes shape."
"Changes shape? It's always been there."
"You know this?
What, you think it recently appeared?"
"You know this? It's always been there?"
"It's a birthmark," Brian said.
"Excuse me, but that's the official biography. I'll tell you what I think. I think if I had a sensitive government job, I would be photographing Gorbachev from outer space every minute of the day that he's not wearing a hat to check the shape of the birthmark if it's changing. Because it's Latvia right now, but it could be Siberia in the morning, where they're emptying out their jails."
He looked at his cigar.
"Reality doesn't happen until you analyze the dots."
Then he got to his feet with a certain effort.
"And when the Cold War goes out of business, you won't be able to look at some woman on the street and have a, what do you call it, kind of fantasy the way you do today."
"Erotic. But what's the connection?"
"You don't know the connection? You don't know that every privilege in your life and every thought in your mind depends on the ability of the two great powers to hang a threat over the planet?"
"That's an amazing thing to say."
"And you don't know that once this threat begins to fade..."
"What?"
"You're the lost man of history."
It seemed the visit was done. But first the host led his guest to a shelved alcove near the stairway. This is where he kept his collection of taped ball games, radio and TV, hundreds of slotted cassettes going back to the earliest broadcasts.
"People who save these bats and balls and preserve old stories through the spoken word and know the nicknames of 1,000 players. We're here in our basements with tremendous history on our walls. And I'll tell you something, you'll see I'm right. There's men in the coming years, they'll pay fortunes for these objects. They'll pay unbelievable. Because this is desperation speaking."
Brian wished the man could be lighter and sweeter. He looked at the scoreboard one last time. He thought finally it was an impressive thing, but maybe a little funereal. It had that compact quality of preservation and exact proportion and respectful history that can produce a mood of mausoleum gloom. They went up the stairs and walked through the shadowed rooms to the front door. Marvin stood there with his dead cigar.
"Men come here to see my collection."
"Yes?"
"They come and they don't want to leave. The phone rings. It's the family. Where is he?" "This is the fraternity of missing men."
"I understand.
What's your name?"
"Brian Glassick."
"Nice to meet you," Marvin said.
Brian asked about a way back to Manhattan that did not include the George Washington Bridge. There was a tunnel here and a tunnel there, and Marvin gave both sets of directions with a number of choices attached to each. Brian, the fool, narrowed his eyes and nodded yes, although he knew he would retain none of this once he was in the car. He drove along turnpikes and skyways, seeing Manhattan come and go in a valium sunset, smoky and golden. The car wobbled in the sound booms of highballing trucks, drivers perched in tall cabs with food, drink, dope, and pornography, and the rigs seemed to draw the little car down the pike in their shearing wind. He drove past enormous tank farms, squat white cylinders arrayed across the swampland, and he saw white domed tanks in smaller groupings and long lines of tank cars rolling down the tracks. He went past power pylons with their spindly arms akimbo. He drove into the spewing smoke of acres of burning truck tires, and the planes descended, and the transit cranes stood in rows at the marine terminal. And he saw billboards for Hertz and Avis and Chevy Blazer, for Marlboro, Continental, and Goodyear. And he realized that all the things around him, the planes taking off and landing, the streaking cars, the tires on the cars, the cigarettes that the drivers of the cars were dousing in their ashtrays, all these were on the billboards around him, systematically linked in some self-referring relationship that had a kind of neurotic tightness and inescapability, as if the billboards were generating reality. And, of course, he thought of Marvin. When he went past Newark Airport, he realized he'd overshot all the turnoffs and their related options. He looked for a friendly exit, untrucked and rural, and found himself some time later on a two-lane blacktop that wended uncertainly through cattail mires. He felt a bitey edge of brine in the air, and the road bent and then ended in gravel and weeds. He got out of the car and climbed an earthen bank. The wind was stiff enough to make his eyes go moist, and he looked across a narrow body of water to a terraced elevation on the other side. It was reddish-brown, flat-topped, monumental, sunset burning in the heights, and Brian thought he was hallucinating an Arizona butte. But it was real, and it was man-made, swept by wheeling gulls, and he knew it could only be one thing, the Freshkills landfill on Staten Island. This was the reason for his trip to New York, and he was scheduled to meet there with surveyors and engineers in the morning. 3,000 acres of mountained garbage, contoured and road-graded, with bulldozers pushing waves of refuse onto the active face. Brian felt invigorated looking at this scene. Barges unloading, sweeper boats poking through the kills to pick up stray waste. He saw a maintenance crew working on drain pipes high on the angled setbacks that were designed to control the runoff of rainwater. Other figures in masks and butylene suits were gathered at the base of the structure to inspect isolated material for toxic content. It was science fiction and prehistory. Garbage arriving 24 hours a day, hundreds of workers, vehicles with metal rollers compacting the trash, bucket augers digging vents for methane gas, the gulls diving and crying, a line of snouted trucks sucking in loose litter. He imagined he was watching the construction of the Great Pyramid at Giza, only this was 25 times bigger, with tanker trucks spraying perfumed water on the approach roads. He found the sight inspiring. All this ingenuity and labor, this delicate effort to fit maximum waste into diminishing space. The towers of the World Trade Center were visible in the distance, and he sensed a poetic balance between that idea and this one. Bridges, tunnels, scows, tugs, graving docks, container ships, all the great works of transport, trade, and linkage were directed in the end to this culminating structure. And the thing was organic, ever-growing and shifting, its shape computer-plotted by the day and the hour. In a few years, this would be the highest mountain on the Atlantic coast between Boston and Miami. Brian felt a sting of enlightenment. He looked at all that soaring garbage and knew, for the first time, what his job was all about. Not engineering or transportation or source reduction. He dealt in human behavior, people's habits and impulses, their uncontrollable needs and innocent wishes, maybe their passions, certainly their excesses and indulgences, but their kindness, too, their generosity. And the question was how to keep this mass metabolism from overwhelming us. The landfill showed him smack on how the waste stream ended, where all the appetites and hankerings, the sodden second thoughts, came runneling out, the things you wanted ardently and then did not. He'd seen 100 landfills, but none so vast as this. Yes, impressive and distressing. He knew the stench must ride the wind into every dining room for miles around. When people heard a noise at night, did they think the heap was coming down around them, sliding toward their homes, an omnivorous movie terror filling their doorways and windows? The wind carried the stink across the kill. Brian took a deep breath. He filled his lungs. This was the challenge he craved, the assault on his complacency and vague shame. To understand all this, to penetrate this secret. The mountain was here, unconcealed, but no one saw it or thought about it. No one knew it existed except the engineers and teamsters and local residents. A unique cultural deposit, 50 million tons by the time they top it off, carved and modeled. And no one talked about it but the men and women who tried to manage it. And he saw himself for the first time as a member of an esoteric order. They were adepts and seers, crafting the future, the city planners, the waste managers, the compost technicians, the landscapers who would build hanging gardens here, make a park one day out of every kind of used and lost and eroded object of desire. The biggest secrets are the ones spread open before us. This was Marvin Lundy talking, filling Brian's head with that dry, staticky voice that seemed to come out of a surgical slit in his throat. The wind carried the stink from the mountain of wrack. Specks and glints, ragtails of color appeared in the stratified mass of covering soil, fabric scraps from the garment center stirred by the wind. Or maybe that teal thing is a bikini brief that belonged to a secretary from Queens. And Brian found he could create a flash infatuation. She is dark-eyed and reads the tabloids, and paints her nails, and eats lunch out of molded styrofoam. And he gives her gifts, and she gives him condoms. And it all ends up here. Newsprint, emery boards, sexy underwear, coaxed into high relief by the rumbling dozers. Think of his multitudinous spermlings with their history of high family foreheads stranded in a Ramsay's body bag and rollered snug in the deep-down waist. He watched several gulls veering in and saw 100 other gulls positioned on a slope, all facing the same way, motionless, regardful, joined in consciousness, in beautiful empty birdness, waiting for the signal to fly. Chapter 4. Marvin was out of his basement, wincing in the light. He steered his car tenaciously, choosing a lane and sticking to it. He wore a tan windbreaker with a plaid lining, because this is what he always wore when the leaves began to turn. It was the faithful change of apparel, an adjustment to the cosmos that made his life seem regular. He wore the jacket through the decades, giving the old one to the Salvation Army and buying another just like it, the everyman tan that he could spot on a store hangar from 50 yards in one of those vast, hushed areas just before closing time, where ranks of suits are arrayed like executives in hell. He also wore a pair of latex gloves, a precaution he took whenever he went to the city. When he got to the Lower East Side, he drove through the streets a number of times before he found a space that looked okay, where he wouldn't get towed and he wouldn't get broken in. And he locked the car and then stood back and studied the parking job he'd done, and the street in general. Old furniture sold cheap, and a truck lot in which every inch of every truck was covered with graffiti. The humans walked by looking touchy and unbeloved. He saw two men in wheelchairs who scooted after cars stopped at the light to scrounge a little change. Marvin walked in his sliding step, his sort of explanatory shuffle. It was a comment on the literature of shuffles. He went down Orchard Street looking at the clothes in the windows and stalls, dry goods by the mile. He stopped to read the writing on a collection of, what do you call, T-shirts. A nasty remark on nearly every item. Words unprintable through history, wearing shirts in a window. A young man stood next to him, thin-limbed and tattooed. A mustache that's half-finished, glaring at him. He felt the glare. A tapered look directed straight into the side of his head. Marvin glanced over.
What? I'm looking in the window, he said.
I look means you gotta look.
I can't look. What? It's a window.
You seen me looking. Means you gotta look.
What? So I can't look?
I'm looking.
It's a public window, Marvin said.
You want window? I give you window.
All of a sudden, this?
You think you want to look? I show you look.
Marvin walked away. Because what else could he do? Flexing his fingers inside the latex gloves. It was impossible to live. You couldn't walk down the street, one foot follows another, because what happens? They kill you. They come out of a door and stab you because you look at them. This is the latest word in death and menace. You look at them, they kill you. One look where you catch their eye, it gives them the right to end your life. Later he crossed Essex Street and found the bakery. What he likes, the backroom business right up front, the ovens and mixing table, where they make bialys in front of your eyes. A man in a white shirt and a white apron with sifted meal on his hands and arms. And Marvin was struck by the force of the moment. A simple drama in a window, the whiteness of bread and work. He thought he could stand here all day and watch the baker shape the pasty mass. He bought for later, for his daughter. Flat rolls, onion-flaked, that were a thing you eat, and a city, and a religion, and a war. He walked down the street with a bakery bag warm against his ribs. He passed a playground, kids crouched and darting on the handball court. And a half-block later, it was all Chinese. When he had his stomach, he used to come here with Eleanor. It was the old mystery of Chinese things, food on steam tables, vegetables he could not identify, the secret minds of the people. He stood and watched the living fish toss in homemade tanks. He bought a fried dumpling and took a bite, more for the gesture than the taste, because he didn't taste the way he used to. It was like the memory of food, the ghost of ginger and minced chives. He shuffled back to the car. He saw the wheelchair beggars with their scraggled beards. They raced each other to a stopped car, bodied forth, hands screwing and cranking. It was a competition of gyrating arms, their eyes peering through the dusty glass for some sign of contact within. But the drivers looked away. The drivers shut their windows against the window washers, the flower sellers, the carjackers, against the medium mad, intent on conversation. You look at them, they kill you. He drove home, leaning tensely toward the wheel. An English girl from Somerset. You couldn't make it up. He played the piano elegy that was Eleanor's favorite music, once a month or so, hitting the repeat button so it never stopped. It was her voice he heard at this time of year, reminding him to get out the tan windbreaker. Time to don the old MacGregor, Marv. In that simple little sentence, word for word through the years, was all the, deep dependency of two people who met during the war, wrote letters back and forth, finally got married, had a child after a while. It took some doing. Two hearts joined in the habit of the days. Dry cleaning. He dry cleaned MacGregor's by the ton. The phone was ringing when he walked in the door. He went into the kitchen, put the bakery bag on the table, took off his jacket. The phone was ringing. He opened the refrigerator and got out the celery tonic and took a swig from the bottle. He was free to do that now. There are compensations, too. He took off the gloves, so tight they resisted separation, peeling them down to the wide part of his hand and then yanking each clinging finger, a process that made him feel part artificial. Then he went across the room to the phone, which was a white wall model with a photograph next to it showing President Reagan standing in the Oval Office between Bobby Thompson and Ralph Branca, which was the only baseball reference anywhere in the house above the basement, a tasseled flag behind them. Because she could be a pain in the ass, Eleanor, on the subject of drinking from the bottle. The phone was ringing. He looked at it and lifted the receiver. They call it a handset now. He was finally selling the house to go live in Clarice's apartment building. The daughter and son-in-law up on 4, the father down on 3, in an easy-to-manage flat with bananas going brown on the windowsill. He would take showers sitting down, while Clarice and Carl went running on their running machine upstairs. They were training to live forever. "I'm calling from Phoenix," said the voice. "The city or the bird?" "Some months ago, a man I know, 10 or 11 months ago, paid you a visit." "I wouldn't recall. Named Brian Glassick. If you tortured me, I wouldn't remember. I have people that come here 6 times. I see them on the street. They could be garment bags on the way to the airport. I function inside my mind." In any case, he recently mentioned the visit. "I wonder what you can tell me about the baseball in the trunk." They would knock on his door to see if he was all right. He'd poke his head past the shower curtain. "All right, I'm fine, all right." "You're a loyal fan retired in Arizona with a heart valve they implanted with Dacron cuffs, and you developed a sweetness for the old days. You spend your career in mergers and acquisitions, made millions, but you're still dissatisfied. You want one last acquisition that's personal from the heart." "Brian said it might go like this." "You want to talk about the ball, you get approximated first. The fact is, I'm ready to sell. People know this. I get calls from men with grainy voices. They have polymer packed in their gums. They have openings that were drilled in their sides for human waste to detour. They come home from the hospital echo-dopplered. I hear from men with quadruple bypass, with nitroglycerin in their bloodstream that you manufacture dynamite. I'm not a fan anymore. I don't follow the teams. I'm in the category myself where I'm undergoing tests. This means I have cancer recurring in so many parts of my body the doctor gives me group rates. Don't worry, you're not supposed to laugh. I'm trying to make you feel bad." "And you're a Dodger fan, yes?" "From before I was born."
"Raised in Brooklyn?"
"Raised in Brooklyn. Get my cheesecake in the Bronx. Go to the Lower East Side for this and that."
"A Dodger fan. But you've reproduced the Polo Grounds scoreboard in your basement."
"To remind me," Marvin said. "Or prepare me, I forget which. I'm not retired, and I haven't made millions. And I don't know exactly why I want to buy the ball." This was good. Marvin liked this. It was good to hear from someone who was not palpitating in his mind for the old Giants or the old New York.
They have stools you can buy in surgical supply outlets that you place in your shower so you can sit and do the far-flung parts of your body without falling and breaking a hip, which he saw one day on the hip replacement channel, with molded seats and non-skid legs. They have a channel for every body part.
"You call me out of nowhere," Marvin said, "and you want to do a deal, but you don't know why."
"That's right," said the voice.
Good, because this was Marvin's situation for a long time. This was Marvin's exact status. For years, he didn't know why he was chasing down exhausted objects. All that frantic passion for a baseball. And he finally understood it was Eleanor on his mind. It was some terror working deep beneath the skin that made him gather up things, amass possessions and effects against the dark shape of some unshoulderable loss. Memorabilia. What he remembered, what lived in the old smoked leather of the catcher's mitt in the basement, was the touch of his Eleanor. Those were his wife's eyes in the oval photographs of men with handlebar mustaches. The state of loss, the fact, the facticity in its lonely length. This was a word he never thought he'd need to use, but here it was, crouched for years in his secluded brain, coming out to elongate the loss.
"I have a mushroom-shaped tumor."
"Yes.
The doctor calls it a fungating mass."
"I don't know that term."
"I don't know it either. It's not in the dictionary, because I looked in two dictionaries. When they get their terms outside the dictionary, it means they're telling you goodbye."
"They went to Chinatown."
"They went to the Jersey Shore and ate harpoon swordfish, which is tastier when the fish dies unstrangled by a net, with olive oil and capers. The last great fish thing on the planet."
"I have to tell you first thing. I don't have the, what do you call, completely established."
"The lineage."
"The lineage. I don't have the lineage all the way."
He told the caller some things about the ball. He said he would make a long story short. Then he made it long. He entertained the man. Why not? And he saw it coming, even as he did the bits and routines, delivered the reliable lines. Clarice would have to rent a hospital bed for the apartment. High sides, so he wouldn't tumble to the floor. Strangers would come to wash his genitals. Immigrants from countries on the Travel Channel, they had lives of their own that he could not imagine a single minute of. He would forget how to eat, how to say simple words. His body would lie there trying to put together the needed elements to take a breath. An oxygen tube in his nose and bananas on the windowsill. He hates them when they're spotted and soft. Clarice speaking slowly, putting a cool cloth to his naked head. "All right, I'm fine, all right." Carl in his pressed white shorts and tube socks, a stockbroker disguised as a boy.
"Do we want to talk about price?" said the voice.
The word for water is water, but he wouldn't be able to say it. The body forgets the basic things. He talked on the phone to Phoenix and looked at his windbreaker hanging on a chair. They went to the Jersey Shore. They made love. They made salads. This was when the terms were in the dictionary. That night he ate half a cantaloupe with grapes clustered in the scooped-out part. This is how they sold it in the supermarket, packed in clinging wrap.
This ends Disc 6.